Over the next 2 years, teacher pay went up $4,400, the fastest growth rate in the nation. Although we still ranked 46th, we were finally above the national average in teacher pay as a percentage of state per capita income, and almost at the national average in the per pupil expenditures as a percentage of income. By 1987, the number of our school districts had dropped to 329, and 85% of the districts had increased their property tax rates, which can be done only by a popular vote to meet the standards. Student test scores rose steadily across the board. In 1986, the Southern Regional Education Board gave a test to 11th graders in five southern states. Arkansas was the only state to score above the national average. When the same group was tested 5 years earlier in 1981, our students scored below the national average. We were on our way. I continued to push for educational improvements for the rest of my time as governor, but the new standards, funding, and accountability measures laid the foundation for all the later progress. Eventually, I reconciled with the AEA and its leaders as we worked together year after year to improve our schools and our children's future. When I look back on my career in politics, the 1983 legislative session on education is one of the things I'm proudest of. In the summer of 1983, the governors met in Portland, Maine. Hillary, Chelsea, and I had a great time getting together with my old friend Bob Reich and his family and going with the other governors to a cookout at Vice President Bush's house in the beautiful oceanside town of Kennebunkport. Three-year-old Chelsea marched up to the vice president and said she needed to go to the bathroom. He took her by the hand and led her there. Chelsea appreciated it, and Hillary and I were impressed by George Bush's kindness. It wouldn't be the last time. Nevertheless, I was upset with the Reagan administration and had come to Maine determined to do something about it. It had just dramatically tightened the eligibility rules for federal disability benefits. Just as with the Black Lung program 10 years earlier, there had been abuses of the disability program, but the Reagan cure was worse than the problem. The regulations were so strict they were ridiculous. In Arkansas, a truck driver with a ninth grade education had lost his arm in an accident. He was denied disability benefits on the theory that he could get a desk job doing clerical work. Several Democrats in the House, including Arkansas Congressman Beryl Anthony, were trying to overturn the rules. Beryl asked me to get the governors to call for their reversal. The governors were interested in the issue because a lot of our disabled constituents were being denied benefits and because we were being held partly responsible. Although the program was funded by the federal government, it was administered by the states. Since the matter wasn't on our agenda, I had to get the relevant committee to vote to overturn the rules by two-thirds, then get 75% of the governors present to support the committee action. It was important enough to the White House that the administration sent two assistant secretaries from the Department of Health and Human Services to work against my efforts. The Republican governors were in a bind. Most of them agreed that the rules needed to be changed and certainly didn't want to defend them in public, but they wanted to stick with their president. The Republican strategy was to kill our proposal in committee. My head count indicated we would win in the committee by a single vote, but only if all our votes showed up. One of those votes was Governor George Wallace. Ever since he had been confined to a wheelchair by a would-be assassin's bullet, it took him a couple of hours every morning to get ready to face the day. On this morning, George Wallace had to get up 2 hours earlier than usual to go through his painful preparations. He came to the meeting and cast a loud aye vote for our resolution after telling the committee how many Alabama working people, black and white, had been hurt by the new disability rules. The resolution passed out of the committee, and the National Governors Association adopted it. Subsequently, Congress overturned the regulations, and a lot of deserving people got the help they needed to survive. It might not have happened if George Wallace hadn't returned to the populous roots of his youth on an early Maine morning when he stood tall in his wheelchair. At the end of the year, our family accepted an invitation from Phil and Linda Later to attend their New Year's weekend gathering in Hilton Head, South Carolina, called Renaissance Weekend. The event was then only a couple of years old. Fewer than 100 families gathered to spend 3 days talking about everything under the sun, from politics and economics to religion and our personal lives. The attendees were of different ages, religions, races, and backgrounds, all bound together by a simple preference for spending the weekend in serious talk and family fun, rather than all-night parties and football games. It was an extraordinary bonding experience. We reveal things about ourselves and learn things about other people that would never have come out under normal circumstances. And all three of us made a lot of new friends, many of whom helped in 1992 and served in my administration. We went to Renaissance Weekend virtually every year after that, until the Millennium Weekend 1999-2000, when the national celebration at the Lincoln Memorial required our presence in Washington. After I became president, the event had swelled to more than 1,500 people and had lost some of its earlier intimacy, but I still enjoyed going. In 1984, it was time to run for re-election again. Even though President Reagan was far more popular in Arkansas and across the country than he had been in 1980, I felt confident. The whole state was excited about implementing the school standards, and the economy was getting a little better. My main primary opponent was Lonnie Turner, the Ozark lawyer I had worked with on black lung cases back in 1975 after his partner Jack Yates died. Lonnie thought the school standards were going to close rural schools, and he was mad about it. It made me sad because of our long friendship and because I thought he should have known better. In May, I won the primary easily, and after a few years, we made up. In July, Colonel Tommy Goodwin, the director of the state police, asked to see me. I sat with Betsy Wright in stunned silence as he told me that my brother had been videotaped selling cocaine to an undercover state police officer, one who ironically had been hired in an expansion of state anti-drug efforts I had asked the legislature to fund. Tommy asked me what I wanted him to do. I asked him what the state police would normally do in a case like this. He said Roger wasn't a big-time dealer, but a cocaine addict who was selling the stuff to support his habit. Typically with someone like him, they'd set him up a few more times on videotape to make sure they had him dead to rights, then squeeze him with the threat of a long prison term to make him give up his supplier. I told Tommy to treat Roger's case just like any other. Then I asked Betsy to find Hillary. She was at a restaurant downtown. I went to pick her up and told her what had happened. For the next 6 miserable weeks, no one outside the state police knew, except Betsy, Hillary, and I believe my completely trustworthy press secretary, Joan Roberts, and me. Every time I saw or talked to Mother, I was heartsick. Every time I looked in the mirror, I was disgusted. I had been so caught up in my life and work that I'd missed all the signs. Shortly after Roger went to college in 1974, he formed a rock band that was good enough to make a living from playing clubs in Hot Springs and Little Rock. I went to hear him several times and thought that with Roger's distinctive voice and the band's musical ability, they had real promise. He clearly loved doing it, and though he went back to Hendrix College a couple of times, he would soon drop out again to return to the band. When he was working, he stayed up all night and slept late. During the racing season, he played the horses heavily. He also bet on football games. I never knew how much he won or lost, but I never asked. When our family gathered for holiday meals, he invariably came late, seemed on edge, and got up a time or two during dinner to make phone calls. The warning signs were all there. I was just too preoccupied to see them. When Roger was finally arrested, it was big news in Arkansas. I made a brief statement to the press, saying that I loved my brother but expected the law to take its course, and asking for prayers and privacy for my family. Then I told my brother and mother the truth about how long I'd known. Mother was in shock, and I'm not sure the reality registered on her. Roger was angry, though he got over it later, when he came to terms with his addiction. We all went to counseling. I learned that Roger's cocaine habit, about 4 grams a day, was so bad it might have killed him if he hadn't had the constitution of an ox, and that his addiction was rooted in part in the scars of his childhood and perhaps a genetic predisposition to addiction he shared with his father. From the time he was arrested until almost the date of his court appearance, Roger couldn't admit that he was an addict. Finally, one day as we were sitting at the breakfast table, I told him that if he wasn't an addict, I wanted him to go to jail for a very long time because he had been selling poison to other people for money. Somehow that got through to him. After he admitted his problem, he began the long road back. The case had been taken over by the U.S. attorney, Asa Hutchinson. Roger gave up his supplier, an immigrant even younger than he was, who got cocaine from family or friends in his home country. Roger pleaded guilty to 2 federal offenses before Judge Orrin Harris, who had been chairman of the Commerce Committee in the House of Representatives, before going to the bench. Judge Harris was in his early 80s, but still sharp and very wise. He sentenced Roger to 3 years on one charge and 2 years on the other, and suspended the 3-year sentence because of his cooperation. Roger served 14 months, most of it in a federal facility for nonviolent offenders, which was hard on him, but probably saved his life. Hillary and I were in court with Mother when he was sentenced. I was impressed by the way the whole thing was handled by Judge Harris and by the U.S. attorney. Asa Hutchinson was professional, fair, and sensitive to the agony my family was experiencing. I wasn't at all surprised when later he was elected to Congress from the 3rd District. In the summer, I led the Arkansas delegation to the Democratic Convention in San Francisco to see Walter Mondale and Geraldine Ferraro nominated and to give a 5-minute tribute to Harry Truman. We were in trouble to start with, and it was all over when Mondale said he would propose a hefty tax increase to reduce the budget deficit. It was a remarkable act of candor, but he might as well have proposed a federal car tag fee. Still, the city put on a great convention. San Francisco had lots of pleasant small hotels within walking distance of the convention center, and well-organized traffic, so we avoided the crushing traffic jams that characterize many conventions. The Arkansas host, Dr. Richard Sanchez, was heavily invested in the efforts to treat and prevent the relatively new disease of AIDS, which was sweeping the city. I asked Richard about the problem and what could be done about it. That was my first real exposure to a battle that would claim a lot of my attention in the White House and afterward. I had to leave San Francisco early to return to Arkansas to recruit a high-tech industry for our state. In the end, it didn't pan out, but I couldn't have done any good staying in California anyway. We were headed for defeat. The economy was rebounding, and the president told us it was morning again in America, while his surrogate sneered at those of us on the other side as San Francisco Democrats, a not-so-veiled allusion to our ties to the city's large gay population. Even Vice President Bush fell into the macho mode, saying he was going to kick a little ass. In the November election, Reagan defeated Mondale 59-41%. The president won 62% of the vote in Arkansas. I received 63% in my race against Woody Freeman, an appealing young businessman from Jonesboro. After our family enjoyed Chelsea's 5th Christmas and our 2nd Renaissance weekend, it was time for a new legislative session, this one devoted to modernizing our economy. Even though the overall economy was improving, unemployment was still high in states like Arkansas that were dependent on agriculture and traditional industries. Most of America's job growth of the 80s came in the high technology and service sectors and was concentrated in and around urban areas, primarily in states on or near the East and West coasts. The industrial and agricultural heartland was still in bad shape. The pattern was so pronounced that people began to refer to America as having a bi-coastal economy. It was obvious that in order to accelerate job and income growth, we had to restructure our economy. The development package I presented to the legislature had some financial components that were new to Arkansas but already in place in other states. I proposed to broaden the state's housing agency into a development and finance authority that would be able to issue bonds to finance industrial, agricultural, and small business projects. I recommended that the state's public pension funds set targets of investing at least 5% of their assets in Arkansas. We were a capital poor state. We didn't need to export public funds when there were good investment options at home. I recommended allowing state-chartered banks to hold assets they foreclosed on for longer periods of time, primarily to avoid dumping farmland in an already depressed market, which would make it even harder for farmers to hold on. I also asked the legislature to allow state-chartered banks not only to lend money, but also to make modest equity investments in farms and businesses that couldn't borrow any more money, with the provision that the farmer or small business person had a right to buy the bank out within 3 years. Other farm state governors were especially interested in this bill, and one of them, Bill Janklow of South Dakota, passed a version of it through his legislature. The economic proposals were innovative, but too complex to be well understood or widely supported. However, after I made appearances at several committee hearings to answer questions and did a lot of one-on-one lobbying, the legislature passed them all. More than a decade after the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Roe v. Wade authorized it, our legislature banned abortions performed in the third trimester of pregnancy. The bill was sponsored by Senator Lou Hardin of Russellville, a Christian whom I liked very much, and Senator Bill Henley, a Catholic who was Susan McDougal's brother. The bill passed easily, and I signed it into law. A decade later, when congressional Republicans were pushing a bill to ban so-called partial birth abortions with no exemption for the health of the mother, I urged them instead to adopt a federal statute banning late-term abortions unless the life or health of the mother was at stake. Because several states still hadn't passed laws like the one I signed in 1985, the bill I proposed would have outlawed more abortions than the bill banning the partial birth procedure, which normally is used to minimize damage to the mother's body. The GOP leadership turned me down. Besides the economic package and the abortion bill, the legislature adopted my proposals to set up a fund to compensate victims of violent crime, strengthen our efforts to reduce and deal with child abuse, establish a fund to provide health care for indigents, mostly poor pregnant women, not covered by the federal Medicaid program, make Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday a state holiday, and create a program to provide better training for school principals. I had become convinced that school performance depended more on the quality of a principal's leadership than on any other single factor. The years ahead only strengthened that conviction. The only real fireworks in a session otherwise devoted to good government and harmless legislative sideshows came from the Herculean effort of the AEA to repeal the teacher testing law just weeks before the test was scheduled to be given for the first time. In a clever move, the teachers got Representative Ode Maddox to sponsor the repeal. Ode was a highly respected former superintendent in his little town of Odin. He was a good Democrat who kept a large old photograph of FDR up in the school auditorium into the 1980s. He was also a friend of mine. Despite the best efforts of my supporters, the repeal passed the House. I immediately put an ad on the radio telling people what had happened and asking them to call the Senate in protest. The switchboard was flooded with calls, and the bill was killed. Instead, the legislature passed a bill that I supported, requiring all certified educators, not just those working in 1985, to take and pass the test by 1987 to keep their certification. The AEA said teachers would boycott the test. The week before it was given, 4,000 teachers demonstrated outside the Capitol and heard a representative of the National Education Association accuse me of assassinating the dignity of the public schools and its children. A week later, more than 90% of our 27,600 teachers showed up for the test. Before the legislature went home, we had one last bit of fireworks. The Highway Department had gone all over the state pushing a new road program to be financed by an increase in gasoline and diesel taxes. The department sold it to the local business and farm leaders, and it passed rather handily, creating a problem for me. I liked the program and thought it would be good for the economy, but in the election I had pledged not to support a major tax increase. So I vetoed the bill and told its sponsors I wouldn't fight their efforts to override it. The override passed easily, the only time in 12 years one of my vetoes was overturned. I also engaged in some national political activity in 1985. In February, I narrated the Democrats' response to President Reagan's State of the Union address. The State of the Union was a great forum for Reagan's speaking skills, and whoever gave our brief response had a hard time making any impression. Our party took a different tack that year, featuring the new ideas and economic achievements of several of our governors and mayors. I also got involved in the newly formed Democratic Leadership Council, a group dedicated to forging a winning message for Democrats based on fiscal responsibility, creative new ideas on social policy, and a commitment to a strong national defense. The Summer Governors Conference held in Idaho was marked by an unusual partisan fight over a fundraising letter for the Republican governor signed by President Reagan. The letter took some hard shots at their Democratic colleagues for being too liberal with tax and spend policies, a violation of our unwritten commitment to keep the governor's meetings bipartisan. The Democrats were so angry, we threatened to block the election of Republican Governor Lamar Alexander of Tennessee to the chairmanship of the National Governors Association, normally a routine action since he was the vice chair and the chairmanship rotated by party every year. I liked Lamar and doubted he had his heart in the attack on his Democratic colleagues. After all, he too had raised taxes to fund higher school standards. I helped to broker a resolution to the conflict, in which the Republicans apologized for the letter and said they wouldn't do it again, and we voted for Lamar for chairman. I was elected vice chairman. We did a lot of good work in the governor's conferences in the 70s and 80s. In the 90s, when the Republican governors gained the majority and got more in line with their national party, the old cooperative spirit diminished. That might have been good politics, but it impaired the search for good policy. On our way to Idaho, Hillary, Chelsea, and I stopped for a few happy days in Montana, thanks largely to Governor Ted Swindon.
End of Disc 14. Disc 15.
On our way to Idaho, Hillary, Chelsea, and I stopped for a few happy days in Montana, thanks largely to Governor Ted Swindon. After we spent the night with him, Ted got us up at dawn to take a helicopter up the Missouri River and watch the wildlife waking up to the day. Then we took a four-wheel drive vehicle equipped with rail connectors along the Burlington Northern Rail Line for a couple of hundred miles. A trip that included a dramatic crossing of a 300-foot deep gorge. And we drove a rented car up the highway to the sun, where we watched marmosets scramble around above the snow line, then spent a few days at Kootenai Lodge on Swan Lake. After all my travels, I still think western Montana is one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen. The political trips I took were a minor diversion from my main mission after the legislature went home in 1985 and for the rest of the decade, building the Arkansas economy. I enjoyed the challenge, and I got pretty good at it. First, I had to stop bad things from happening. When International Paper announced plans to close a mill in Camden that had been operating since the 1920s, I flew to New York to see the company president, John George, and asked him what it would take to keep the mill open. He gave me a list of five or six things he wanted. I delivered on all but one, and he kept the plant open. When my friend Turner Whitson called to tell me the shoe plant in Clarksville was closing, I turned for help to Don Monroe, who had managed to keep six shoemaking facilities open in Arkansas during the worst of the 80s recession. I offered him $1 million in assistance, and he took over the plant. The workers found out about their jobs being saved at a meeting to help them file for unemployment and retraining benefits. When the Sanyo Company told me it was planning to close its television assembly plant in Forest City, Dave Harrington and I flew to Osaka, Japan, to see Satoshi Iui, the president of Sanyo, a vast company with more than 100,000 employees worldwide. I had become friends with Mr. Iui over the years. After I was defeated for governor in 1980, he sent me a beautiful piece of Japanese calligraphy that said, "Though the river may force you to change course, hold fast to what you believe." I had it framed, and when I was reelected in 1982, it hung at the entrance to our bedroom so I would see it every day. I told Mr. Iui that we couldn't handle the loss of Sanyo's jobs in eastern Arkansas, where the Delta counties all had unemployment rates higher than 10%. I asked him if he would keep the plant open if Walmart would sell Sanyo's televisions. After he agreed, I flew back to Arkansas and asked Walmart to help. In September 2003, Satoshi Iui came to Chappaqua for lunch. By then, Walmart had bought more than 20 million of those television sets. It wasn't all rescue missions. We also made some new things happen, financing new high-tech ventures, involving the universities in helping start new businesses, taking successful trade and investment missions to Europe and Asia, and supporting the expansion of successful plants like the ones run by Daiwa Steel Tube Industries in Pine Bluff and the Dana Company in Jonesboro, which made transmissions with the help of skilled workers and amazing robots. Our biggest coup was getting Nucor Steel Company to come to Northeast Arkansas. Nucor was a highly profitable company that made steel by melting already forged metal rather than creating it from scratch. Nucor paid workers a modest weekly wage and a bonus based on profits, a bonus that usually accounted for more than half the workers' income. By 1992, the Arkansas Nucor workers' average income was about $50,000. Moreover, Nucor gave every employee an extra $1,500 a year for every child he or she had in college. One of its employees educated 11 children with the company's help. Nucor had no corporate jet and operated with a tiny headquarters staff out of rented space in North Carolina. The founder, Ken Iverson, inspired great loyalty the old-fashioned way. He earned it. The only year Nucor's earnings were down in the 1980s, Iverson sent a letter to his employees apologizing for the cut in their pay, which was applied across the board because Nucor had a strict no-layoff policy. The benefits and burdens were shared equally, except for the boss. Iverson said it wasn't the workers' fault that market conditions were poor, but he should have figured out a way to deal with them. He told his workers he was taking a 60% pay cut, three times theirs, a dramatic departure from the common practice for the last two decades of raising executive pay at a far greater rate than that of other employees, whether the company is doing well or not. Needless to say, no one at Nucor wanted to quit. When the Van Heusen Shirt Company announced it was closing its Brinkley plant, Ferris and Marilyn Burroughs, who had been involved with the workers and community for years, decided to buy it and keep it open. But they needed more customers for their shirts. I asked David Glass, the president of Walmart, if he would stock them. Again, Walmart came to the rescue. Shortly afterward, I hosted a lunch for Walmart executives and our economic development people to encourage the company to buy more products made in America and to advertise this practice as a way to increase sales. Walmart's Buy America campaign was a great success and helped to reduce resentment against the giant discounter for putting small-town merchants out of business. Hillary loved the program and supported it strongly when she went on the Walmart board a couple of years later. At its high water mark, Walmart's merchandise was about 55% American-made, about 10% more than that of its nearest competitor. Unfortunately, after a few years, Walmart abandoned the policy in its marketing drive to be the lowest-cost retailer. But we made the most of it in Arkansas while it lasted. The work I did in education and economic development convinced me that Arkansas and America had to make some big changes if we wanted to preserve our economic and political leadership in the global economy. We simply weren't well-educated or productive enough. We had been losing ground in average incomes since 1973, and by the 1980s, 4 in 10 workers were experiencing declining incomes. The situation was intolerable, and I was determined to do what I could to change it. My efforts helped to broaden my political base, garnering support from Republicans and conservative independents who had never voted for me before. Even though Arkansas had been in the top 10 states in new job growth as a percentage of total employment in 2 of the last 3 years, I couldn't convert everybody. When the oil refinery in El Dorado was about to close, costing us more than 300 good union jobs, I helped convince some business people from Mississippi to buy and operate it. I knew how much it meant to those workers' families and to the local economy, and I looked forward to shaking hands at the plant gate at the next election. It was a home run, until I met a man who angrily said he wouldn't vote for me under any circumstances. When I responded, "Don't you know I saved your job?" he replied, "Yeah, I know you did, but you don't care a thing about me. You only did it so you'd have one more poor sucker to tax. That's why you want me to have a job, so you can tax me. I wouldn't vote for you for all the money in the world." You can't win them all. In early 1986, I launched my campaign for re-election, this one for a 4-year term. In 1984, the voters had passed an amendment to change executive terms from 2 to 4 years for the first time since our Reconstruction-era Constitution was adopted in 1874. If I won, I would become the second longest-serving Arkansas governor after Orville Faubus. He won his longevity because of Little Rock Central High. I wanted to win mine on schools and jobs. Ironically, my main opponent in the primary was Faubus himself. He was still angry at me because in my first term, I refused to have the state buy his beautiful Fay Jones house in Huntsville and put it into the state park system to be used as a retreat. I knew he was strapped for cash, but so was the state, and I couldn't justify the expense. Faubus was going to rail against the new education standards, saying they had brought consolidation and high taxes to rural areas, which hadn't gotten any of the new jobs I was always bragging about. And once I got by Faubus, Frank White was waiting. He was trying to win the best 2 out of 3. Between the two of them, I knew a lot of charges would fly. I felt confident that Betsy Wright, Dick Morris, David Watkins, and I could deal with whatever came up. But I was concerned about how Chelsea would react to people saying bad things about her father. She was 6 and had begun to watch the news and even to read the paper. Hillary and I tried to prepare her for what White and Faubus might say about me and how I would respond. Then for several days we would take turns playing one of the candidates. One day Hillary was Frank White, I was Faubus, and Chelsea was me. I accused her of ruining the small schools with misguided education ideas. She shot back, "Well, at least I didn't use the state police to spy on my political enemies the way you did." Faubus had actually done that in the aftermath of the Central High crisis. Not bad for a six-year-old. I won the primary with more than 60% of the vote, but Faubus pulled a third of it. Even at 76, he still had some juice in rural areas. Frank White took up where Faubus left off. Although he had called teachers greedy when they pushed for higher pay during his tenure, he got the endorsement of the Arkansas Education Association in the Republican primary when he changed his position from support of the teacher test to opposition. Then he started in on Hillary and me. White began by saying the new education standards were too burdensome and needed to be changed. I hit that one out of the park, saying if he were elected, he would delay them to death. Then he went after Hillary, alleging she had a conflict of interest because the Rose firm was representing the state in its fight against the Grand Gulf nuclear plants. We had a good response to that charge, too. First, the Rose firm was working to save Arkansans' money by lifting the burden of the Grand Gulf plants, while White, as a board member of one of the Middle South utilities companies, had voted three times to go forward with construction of the plants. Second, the Public Service Commission hired the Rose firm because all the other big firms were representing utilities or other parties in the case. Both the legislature and the Attorney General approved the hiring. Third, the money the state paid to the Rose firm was subtracted from the firm's income before Hillary's partnership profits were calculated, so she made no money from it. White seemed more interested in defending the utility's effort to soak Arkansas ratepayers than protecting them from a conflict of interest. I asked him if his attacks on Hillary meant he wanted to run for first lady instead of governor. Our campaign even made bumper stickers and buttons that said, "Frank for First Lady." White's final charges did him in. He had been working for Stevens, Inc., then the largest bond house outside Wall Street. Jack Stevens had supported me when I first ran for governor, but then he drifted to the right, heading Democrats for Reagan in 1984, and by 1986 he had become a Republican. His older brother, Whit, was still a Democrat and supporting me, but Jack ran the bond house. And Frank White was his guy. For many years, Stevens had controlled the state's bond business. When I dramatically expanded the volume of bond issues, I insisted that we open all of them to competitive bidding by national firms and that we let more Arkansas firms have the opportunity to sell the bonds. The Stevens firm still got its fair share, but it didn't control all the issues as it had in the past and would again if White won the election. One of the Arkansas firms that got some business was headed by Dan Lassiter, who built a successful bond firm in Little Rock before he lost it all to a cocaine habit. Lassiter had been a supporter of mine and a friend of my brother's, with whom he had partied hard when they were both chained to cocaine, as too many young people were in the 1980s. When Betsy Wright and I were preparing for our television debate with White, we learned that he was going to challenge me to take a drug test with him. The ostensible reason was to set a good example, but I knew White was hoping I wouldn't do it. The blizzard of rumors spawned by Lassiter's downfall included one that I had been part of Dan's party circle. It wasn't true. Betsy and I decided to take a drug test before the debate. When White hit me on television with his challenge, I smiled and said Betsy and I had already taken a test, and he and his campaign manager, Daryl Glassick, should follow suit. Glassick had been subjected to his share of rumors, too. Their clever trick had backfired. White turned up the heat with the nastiest TV ad I'd ever seen. He showed Lassiter's office, followed by a tray of cocaine with an announcer saying, "I'd taken campaign contributions from a cocaine-using felon, then given him state bond business." The clear implication was that I'd given Lassiter preferred treatment and at the least I had known about his cocaine habit when I did. I invited the Arkansas Gazette to review the records of the Development Finance Authority, and the paper ran a front-page story showing how many more bond houses had done business with the state since I'd taken over from Governor White. The number had gone from 4 to 15, and Stevens still had handled over $700 million of bond business, more than twice as much as any other Arkansas firm. I also hit back with a TV ad that began by asking people if they had seen White's ad and actually showing a few seconds of it. Then my ad cut to a picture of Stevens, Inc., with the announcer saying White worked there, and the reason he was attacking me was that neither Stevens nor anyone else controlled the state's business any longer, but they would if White became governor again. It was one of the most effective commercials I ever ran, because it was a strong response to a low blow and because the facts spoke for themselves. I was also glad that Roger and Mother hadn't let themselves get too hurt by White's bringing up Roger's drug problem. After he got out of prison, Roger served 6 months in a halfway house in Texas and then moved to North Arkansas, where he worked for a friend of ours in a quick stop service station. He was about to move to Nashville, Tennessee, and was healthy enough not to let the old story drag him down. Mother was happy with Dick Kelly, and by now knew that politics was a rough game in which the only answer to a low blow is winning. In November, I won with 64%, including a staggering 75% in Little Rock. I was gratified that the victory gave me the opportunity to smash the suggestion that I had abused the governor's office and the implication that drugs had something to do with it. Despite the tough campaign, I wasn't very good at holding a grudge. Over the years, I came to like Frank White and his wife Gay and to enjoy being on programs with him. He had a great sense of humor, he loved Arkansas, and I was sad when he died in 2003. Thankfully, I also reconciled with Jack Stevens. As far as I was concerned, the campaign against Faubus and White was a battle against Arkansas's past and against the emerging politics of personal destruction. I wanted to focus the people on the issues and on the future by defending our education reforms and promoting our economic initiatives. The Memphis Commercial Appeal reported that Clinton's stump speeches in the area sound as much like seminars on economy as pleas for votes, and most political analysts agree that the strategy is working. I often told the story of my visit to the Arkansas Eastman Chemical Plant in rural Independence County. During the tour, my host kept saying that all the anti-pollution equipment was run by computers, and he wanted me to meet the guy who was running them. He built him up so much that by the time I got to the computer control room, I expected to meet someone who was a cross between Albert Einstein and the Wizard of Oz. Instead, the man running the computers was wearing cowboy boots, jeans with a belt adorned with a big silver rodeo buckle, and a baseball cap. He was listening to country music and chewing tobacco. The first thing he said to me was, "My wife and I are going to vote for you, because we need more jobs like this." This guy raised cattle and horses. He was pure Arkansas. But he knew his prosperity depended more on what he knew than on how much he could do with his hands and back. He had seen the future, and he wanted to go there. In August, when the National Governors Association met in Hilton Head, South Carolina, I became the chairman and celebrated my 40th birthday. I had already agreed to serve as chairman of the Education Commission of the States, a group dedicated to gathering the best education ideas and practices and spreading them across the nation. Lamar Alexander had also appointed me to be the Democratic co-chairman of the Governor's Task Force on Welfare Reform, to work with the White House and Congress to develop a bipartisan proposal to improve the welfare system so that it would promote work, strengthen families, and meet children's basic needs. Though I had secured an increase in Arkansas's meager monthly welfare benefits in 1985, I wanted welfare to be a way station on the road to independence. I was excited with these new responsibilities. I was both a political animal and a policy wonk, always eager to meet new people and explore new ideas. I thought the work would enable me to be a better governor, strengthen my network of national contacts, and gain a better understanding of the emerging global economy and how America should deal with its challenges. As 1986 drew to a close, I took a quick trip to Taiwan to address the 10th Annual Conference of Taiwanese and American Leaders about our future relations. The Taiwanese were good customers for Arkansas soybeans and a wide variety of our manufactured products, from electric motors to parking meters. But America's trade deficit was large and growing, and 4 in 10 American workers had suffered declining incomes in the previous 5 years. Speaking for all the governors, I acknowledged America's responsibility to cut our deficit to bring down interest rates and increase domestic demand, to restructure and reduce the debt of our Latin American neighbors, to relax export controls on high technology products, and to improve the education and productivity of our workforce. Then I challenged the Taiwanese to reduce trade barriers and invest more of their huge cash reserves in America. It was my first speech on global economics to a foreign audience. Making it forced me to sort out exactly what I thought should be done and who should do it. By the end of 1986, I had formed some basic convictions about the nature of the modern world, which later developed into the so-called New Democrat philosophy that was the backbone of my 1992 campaign for president. I outlined them in a speech to the year-end management meeting of Gannett, the newspaper chain that had just bought the Arkansas Gazette. These are the new rules that I believe should provide the framework within which we make policy today. 1. Change may be the only constant in today's American economy. I was at an old country church celebration in Arkansas about 3 months ago to celebrate its 150th anniversary. There were about 75 people there, all packed in this small wooden church. After the service, we went out under the pine trees to have a potluck lunch, and I found myself talking to an old man who was obviously quite bright. Finally, I asked him, "Mister, how old are you?" He said, "I'm 82. "When did you join this church?" 1916, he said. "If you had to say in one sentence, what is the difference between our state now and in 1916? He was quiet for a moment, then said, "Governor, that's pretty easy. In 1916, when I got up in the morning, I knew what was going to happen. But when I get up in the morning now, I don't have any idea." That is about as good a one-sentence explanation about what has happened to America as Lester Thurow could give. 2, human capital is probably more important than physical capital now. 3, a more constructive partnership between business and government is far more important than the dominance of either. 4, as we try to solve problems which arise out of our internationalization of American life and the changes in our own population, cooperation in every area is far more important than conflict. We have to share responsibilities and opportunities. We're going up or down together. 5, waste is going to be punished. It appears to me that we are spending billions of dollars of investment capital increasing the debt of corporations without increasing their productivity. More debt should mean increased productivity, growth, and profitability. Now it means too often less employment, less investment for research and development, and forced restructuring to service non-productive debt. 6, a strong America requires a resurgent sense of community, a strong sense of mutual obligations, and a conviction that we cannot pursue our individual interest independent of the needs of our fellow citizens. If we want to keep the American dream alive for our own people and preserve America's role in the world, we must accept the new rules of successful economic, political and social life, and we must act on them. Over the next 5 years, I would refine my analysis of globalization and interdependence and propose more initiatives to respond to them, juggling as best I could my desire to be a good governor and to have a positive impact on national policy. In 1987, my agenda for the legislative session, Good Beginnings, Good Schools, Good Jobs, was consistent with the work I was doing with the National Governors Association under the theme, Making America Work. In addition to recommendations that built on our previous efforts in education and economic development, I asked the legislature to help me get the growing number of poor children off to a good start in life by increasing health care coverage for poor mothers and children, starting with prenatal care in order to lower the infant mortality rate and reduce avoidable damage to newborns, to increase parenting education for mothers of at-risk children, to provide more special education in early childhood to kids with learning problems, to increase the availability of affordable child care, and to strengthen child support enforcement. From Hillary, I had learned most of what I knew about early childhood development and its importance to later life. She had been interested in it as long as I'd known her, and had taken a fourth year at Yale Law School to work on children's issues at the Yale Child Study Center and Yale New Haven Hospital. She had worked hard to import to Arkansas an innovative preschool program from Israel called HIPPI, which stands for Home Instruction Programs for Preschool Youngsters, a program that helps to develop both parenting skills and children's ability to learn. Hillary set up HIPPI programs all across the state. We both loved going to the graduation exercises, watching the children show their stuff, and seeing the parents' pride in their kids and themselves. Thanks to Hillary, Arkansas had the largest program in the country, serving 2,400 mothers, and their children showed remarkable progress. The main focus of my economic development efforts was to increase investment and opportunity for poor people and distressed areas, most of them in rural Arkansas. The most important proposal was to provide more capital to people who had the potential to operate profitable small businesses but couldn't borrow the money to get started. The South Shore Development Bank in Chicago had been instrumental in helping unemployed carpenters and electricians set themselves up in business on the city's south side to renovate abandoned buildings that otherwise would have been condemned. As a result, the whole area recovered. I knew about the bank because one of its employees, Jan Piercy, had been one of Hillary's best friends at Wellesley. Jan told us South Shore got the idea to fund artisans who were skilled but not creditworthy by conventional standards from the work of Grameen Bank of Bangladesh, founded by Muhammad Yunus, who had studied economics at Vanderbilt University before going home to help his people. I arranged to meet him for breakfast in Washington one morning, and he explained how his microcredit program worked. Village women who had skills and a reputation for honesty but no assets were organized in teams. When the first borrower repaid her small loan, the next one in line got hers, and so on. When I first met Eunice, the Grameen Bank had already made hundreds of thousands of loans with a repayment rate higher than that for commercial lenders in Bangladesh. By 2002, Grameen had made them to more than 2.4 million people, 95% of them poor women. If the idea worked in Chicago, I thought it would work in economically distressed areas in rural Arkansas. As Eunice said in an interview, "Anywhere anybody is rejected by the banking system, you have room for a Grameen-type program." We set up the Southern Development Bank Corporation in Arkadelphia. The Development Finance Authority put up some of the initial money, but most of it came from corporations that Hillary and I asked to invest in it. When I became president, I secured congressional approval for a national loan program modeled on the Grameen Bank and featured some of our success stories at a White House event. The U.S. Agency for International Development also funded 2 million microcredit loans a year in poor villages in Africa, Latin America, and East Asia. In 1999, when I went to South Asia, I visited Muhammad Yunus and some of the people he had set up in business, including women who'd used the loans to buy cell phones, which they charged villagers to use to call their relatives and friends in America and Europe. Muhammad Yunus should have been awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics years ago. My other major interest was welfare reform. I asked the legislature to require recipients with children 3 years old or over to sign a contract committing themselves to a course of independence through literacy, job training, and work. In February, I went to Washington with several other governors to testify before the House Ways and Means Committee on welfare prevention and reforms. We asked Congress to give us the tools to promote work, not welfare. Independence, not dependence. We argued that more should be done to keep people off welfare in the first place by reducing adult illiteracy, teen pregnancy, the school dropout rate, and alcohol and drug abuse. On welfare reform, we advocated a binding contract between the recipient and the government, setting out the rights and responsibilities of both parties. Recipients would commit to strive for independence in return for the benefits, and the government would commit to help them with education and training, medical care, child care, and job placement. We also asked that all welfare recipients with children aged 3 or older be required to participate in a work program designed by the states, that each welfare recipient have a caseworker committed to a successful transition to self-sufficiency, that efforts to collect child support payments be intensified, and that a new formula for cash assistance be established consistent with each state's cost of living. Federal law allowed states to set monthly benefits wherever they chose, as long as they weren't lower than they had been in the early 70s, and they were all over the place. I had spent enough time talking to welfare recipients and caseworkers in Arkansas to know that the vast majority of them wanted to work and support their families. But they faced formidable barriers, beyond the obvious ones of low skills, lack of work experience, and inability to pay for child care. Many of the people I met had no cars or access to public transportation. If they took a low-wage job, they would lose food stamps and medical coverage under Medicaid. Finally, many of them just didn't believe they could make it in the world of work and had no idea where to begin. At one of our governor's meetings in Washington, along with my welfare reform co-chair, Governor Mike Castle of Delaware, I organized a meeting for other governors on welfare reform. I brought 2 women from Arkansas who had left welfare for work to testify. One young woman from Pine Bluff had never been on an airplane or an escalator before the trip. She was restrained but convincing about the potential of poor people to support themselves and their children. The other witness was in her mid to late 30s. Her name was Lily Harden, and she had recently found work as a cook. I asked her if she thought able-bodied people on welfare should be forced to take jobs if they were available. "I sure do," she answered. "Otherwise, we'll just lay around watching soaps all day." Then I asked Lily what was the best thing about being off welfare. Without hesitation, she replied, "When my boy goes to school and they ask him, 'What does your mama do for a living?' he can give them an answer." It was the best argument I've ever heard for welfare reform. After the hearing, the governors treated her like a rock star. When I tackled welfare reform as president, I was always somewhat amused to hear some members of the press characterize it as a Republican issue, as if valuing work was something only conservatives did. By 1996, when Congress passed a bill I could sign, I had been working on welfare reform for more than 15 years. But I didn't consider it a Democratic issue, or even a governor's issue. Welfare reform was about Lily Hardin and her boy. Chapter 24. Thanks to the 4-year term, the dedication and ability of my staff and cabinet, a good working relationship with the legislature, and the strength of my political organization, I also had the space to move into the national political arena. Because of the visibility I got from my work on education, economics, and welfare reform, and my chairmanships of the National Governors Association and the Education Commission of the States, I received a lot of invitations to speak out of state in 1987. I accepted more than 24 of them in 15 states. While only 4 were Democratic Party events, they all served to broaden my contacts and to heighten speculation that I might enter the presidential race. Although I was only 40 in the spring of 1987, I was interested in making the race for 3 reasons. First, by historical standards, the Democrats had an excellent chance to recapture the White House. It seemed clear that Vice President Bush would be the nominee of the Republican Party, and up until then, the only vice president to win the presidency directly from that office had been Martin Van Buren in 1836, who succeeded Andrew Jackson in the last election in which there was no effective opposition to the Democratic Party. Second, I felt very strongly that the country had to change direction. Our growth was fueled primarily by big increases in defense spending and large tax cuts that disproportionately benefited the wealthiest Americans and drove up the deficit. The big deficits led to high interest rates as the government competed with private borrowers for money, and that in turn drove up the value of the dollar, making imports cheaper and American exports more expensive. At a time when Americans were beginning to improve their productivity and competitive position, we were still losing manufacturing jobs and farms. Moreover, because of the budget deficit, we weren't investing enough in the education, training, and research required to maintain high wages and low unemployment in the global economy. That's why 40% of the American people had suffered a decline in real income since the mid-1970s. The third reason I was seriously considering entering the race is that I thought I understood what was happening and could explain it to the American people. Also, because I had a strong record on crime, welfare reform, accountability and education, and fiscal responsibility, I didn't think the Republicans could paint me as an ultra-liberal Democrat who didn't embrace mainstream values and who thought there was a government program for every problem. I was convinced that if we could escape the alien box the Republicans had put us in since 1968, except for President Carter's success in 1976, we could win the White House again. It was a tall order because it's not easy to get people to change their political frame of reference, but I thought I might be able to do it. So did several of my fellow governors. When I went to the Indianapolis 500 race in the spring, I ran into Governor Bob Kerry of Nebraska. I liked Bob a lot and thought he, too, would be a good presidential candidate. He had won the Medal of Honor in Vietnam and, like me, was a fiscal conservative and social progressive who had been elected in a state far more Republican than Arkansas. To my surprise, Bob encouraged me to run and said he'd be my chairman in the Midwestern states if I did. There was one obstacle at home to my running for president. Dale Bumpers was seriously considering it. I had been encouraging him to run since late 1974. He almost did in 1984, and he had an excellent chance to win this time. He had served in the Marines in World War II, had been a great governor, and was the best speaker in the Senate. I knew that Dale would be a good president and that he would have a better chance to win than I would. I would have been happy to support him. I wanted our side to win and change the direction of the country. On March 20th, as I was jogging down Main Street in Little Rock, a local reporter chased me down to say that Senator Bumpers had just issued a statement saying he wouldn't run for president. He just didn't want to do it. A few weeks earlier, Governor Mario Cuomo of New York had made the same decision. I told Hillary and Betsy I wanted to take a serious look at the race. We raised a little money for the exploratory effort, and Betsy sent people to do spade work in Iowa, New Hampshire, and some of the southern states that would vote in a block the next year on Super Tuesday, shortly after the New Hampshire primary. On May 7th, the primary looked even more winnable when Senator Gary Hart, who had almost upset Vice President Mondale in 1984, withdrew from the race after his relationship with Donna Rice was exposed. I thought Gary had made an error by challenging the press to tail him to see if they could find any dirt, but I felt bad for him, too. He was a brilliant, innovative politician who was always thinking about America's big challenges and what to do about them. After the Hart affair, those of us who had not led perfect lives had no way of knowing what the press's standards of disclosure were. Finally, I concluded that anyone who believed he had something to offer should just run, deal with whatever charges arose, and trust the American people. Without a high pain threshold, you can't be a successful president anyway. I set July 14th as a deadline for making a decision. Several of my old friends from past political battles came down to Little Rock, including Mickey Cantor, Carl Wagner, Steve Cohen, John Holum, and Sandy Berger. They all thought I should run. It seemed too good a chance to pass up. Still, I was holding back. I knew I was ready to be a good candidate, but I wasn't sure I had lived long enough to acquire the wisdom and judgment necessary to be a good president. If elected, I would be 42, about the same age Theodore Roosevelt was when he was sworn in after President McKinley's assassination, and a year younger than John Kennedy when he was elected. But they both had come from wealthy, politically prominent families and had grown up in a way that made them comfortable in the circles of power. My two favorite presidents, Lincoln and FDR, were 51 when they took office, fully mature and in command of themselves and their responsibilities. 10 years later, on my 51st birthday, Al Gore gave me an account of the Cherokee Indian Nation's view of the aging process. The Cherokees believe a man does not reach full maturity until he is 51. The second thing that bothered me was the difficulties a campaign would pose for my governorship. 1987 was the deadline for implementing the school standards. I had already called one special session to raise money for schools and overcrowded prisons. It had been a knockdown fight that had strained my relations with several legislators, and it very nearly ended in failure before we scraped together enough votes at the last minute to do what had to be done. I knew that, in all probability, I'd have to call another special session in early 1988. I was determined to fully implement the school standards and build on them. It was the only chance most poor kids in my state had for a better future. Chelsea's elementary school was about 60% black, and more than half the kids were from low-income families. I remember how one little boy she invited to her birthday party at the mansion almost didn't come because he couldn't afford to buy her a present. I was determined to give that little boy a better chance than his parents had had. The Arkansas Gazette, which had supported me in every campaign, ran an editorial arguing that I shouldn't run for both of the reasons that concerned me. While acknowledging my strong potential for national leadership, the Gazette said, "Bill Clinton is not ready to be president, and Governor Clinton is needed in Arkansas." Ambition is a powerful force, and the ambition to be president has led many a candidate to ignore both his own limitations and the responsibilities of the office he currently holds. I always thought I could rise to any occasion, stand the most withering fire, and do two or three jobs at once. In 1987, I might have made a decision rooted in self-confidence and driven by ambition, but I didn't. What finally decided the question for me was the one part of my life politics couldn't reach: Chelsea. Carl Wagner, who was also the father of an only daughter, told me I'd have to reconcile myself to being away from Chelsea for most of the next 16 months. Mickey Cantor was talking me through it when Chelsea asked me where we were going for summer vacation. When I said I might not be able to take one if I ran for president, Chelsea replied, "Then Mom and I will go without you." That did it. I went into the dining room of the governor's mansion where my friends were eating lunch, told them I wasn't running, and apologized for bringing them all down. Then I went to the Excelsior to make my announcement to a few hundred supporters. I did my best to explain how I had come so close, yet backed away. I need some family time. I need some personal time. Politicians are people, too. I think sometimes we forget it, but they really are. The only thing I or any other candidate has to offer in running for president is what's inside. That's what sets people on fire and gets their confidence and their votes, whether they live in Wisconsin or Montana or New York. That part of my life needs renewal. The other, even more important reason for my decision is the certain impact that this campaign would have had on our daughter. The only way I could have won getting in this late, after others had been working up to 2 years, would be to go on the road full time from now until the end, and to have Hillary do the same. I've seen a lot of kids grow up under these pressures, and a long, long time ago, I made a promise to myself that if I was ever lucky enough to have a child, she would never grow up wondering who her father was. Though she had said she would support me whichever way I went, Hillary was relieved. She thought I should finish the work I had started in Arkansas and keep building a national base of support. And she knew it was not a good time for me to be away from our families. Mother was having problems in her anesthesia work. Roger had been out of prison only a couple of years, and Hillary's parents were moving to Little Rock. In January 1983, during my swearing-in speech to the legislature, Hugh Rodham had slumped in his chair. He had suffered a massive heart attack and was rushed to the University Medical Center for quadruple bypass surgery. I was with him when he woke up. After I realized he was lucid, I said, "Hugh, the speech wasn't good enough to give anyone a heart attack." In 1987, he had a minor stroke. Hugh and Dorothy didn't need to stay up in Park Ridge alone. We wanted them nearby, and they were looking forward to the move, mostly to be near their only grandchild. Still, it would be a big adjustment for them. Finally, Hillary was happy I didn't run because she disagreed with the conventional wisdom that the Democrats were likely to win in 1988. She didn't think the Reagan Revolution had run its course and believed that despite the Iran-Contra affair, George Bush would win as a more moderate version of Reagan. 4 years later, when prospects for victory looked much darker, with President Bush's approval ratings over 70%, Hillary encouraged me to run. As usual, she was right both times. After the decision was announced, I felt as though the weight of the world had been lifted from my shoulders. I was free to be a father, husband, and governor, and to work and speak on national issues unencumbered by immediate ambitions. In July, Hillary, Chelsea, and I went to the Summer Governors Conference in Traverse City, Michigan, to wrap up my year as chairman. I was succeeded by New Hampshire Governor John Sununu, who promised to continue our work for welfare reform and with whom I had a good relationship. After we adjourned, the Democratic governors went to Mackinac Island, where Governor Jim Blanchard brought us together to meet with all our presidential candidates, including Senator Al Gore, Senator Paul Simon, Senator Joe Biden, Congressman Dick Gephardt, the Reverend Jesse Jackson, former Governor Bruce Babbitt of Arizona, and Governor Mike Dukakis. I thought we had a good field, but I favored Dukakis. In Massachusetts, he had presided over a successful high-tech economy, had balanced budgets, and had advanced both education and welfare reform. He was governing as a new Democrat, and he knew what it was like to lose an election to negative attacks and make a successful comeback. Even though most Americans thought of Massachusetts as a liberal state, I believed we could sell him because he was a successful governor and would avoid the errors that had sunk us in previous elections. Besides, we were friends. Mike was relieved when I didn't enter the race and gave me an early birthday present, a T-shirt inscribed with the words, "Happy 41st, Clinton in 96, you'll only be 49. At the end of the meeting, Jim Blanchard put on a terrific rock and roll concert featuring Motown artists from the 60s, including the Four Tops, Martha Reeves and the Vandellas, and Junior Walker, a legendary tenor sax player who could make the horn play an octave higher than most of us mere mortals could. Near the end of the show, a young woman came up to me and invited me to play the sax with all the groups on the Motown standard, Dancing in the Street. I hadn't played a note in 3 years. "Is there any sheet music?" I asked. "No," she said. "What key is it in?" She answered, "I don't have a clue. Can I have a couple of minutes to warm up the horn?" Again, no. I gave the only possible answer. "Okay, I'll do it." I went up to the stage. They gave me a horn, promptly attached a mic to the bell, and the music started. I played as softly as I could until I tuned the horn and figured out the key. Then I joined in and did pretty well. I still keep a picture of Junior Walker and me doing a riff together. September was a busy month. With the new school year starting, I appeared on NBC's Meet the Press along with Bill Bennett, who had succeeded Terrell Bell as President Reagan's Secretary of Education. I got along with Bennett, who appreciated my support for accountability and teaching kids basic values in school, and he didn't disagree when I said the states needed more federal help to pay for early childhood programs. When Bennett criticized the National Education Association as an obstacle to accountability, I said I thought the NEA was doing better on that score and reminded him that Al Shanker, leader of the other big teachers' union, the American Federation of Teachers, supported both accountability and values education.